and welcome to the Eastern Front. My name is Alvaro Hash, and I'm a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. I'm joined by my friends
Giselle Donnelly. I also work at AAI, and
Yulia Zhoja with the Middle East Institute, Georgetown, and George Washington Universities.
On our podcast, we talk about the challenges to European peace and security that have erupted along a line running from the Baltic Sea to the Black Sea, the Eastern Front, and about why those matter to the United States. Our special guest today is Andrea Michalcova, director at the Center for an Informed Society in Prague. If you enjoyed this episode, please consider subscribing, rating, and reviewing us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Andrea, it's great to have you on the podcast. You have been working on the subject of disinformation and Russian propaganda for quite some time. You have advised governments in Central Europe. Last year, though, you decided to set up your own organization dedicated to the cause. Can you tell us a little bit about why you made that decision, what your group does, what your main focus of activities is, and give us a sort of sense of the state of countering Russian disinfo in a place like the Czech Republic?
Hello, everyone. Thank you very much for having me. I decided to leave European Values for Security Policy because I worked there for almost 10 years. As you mentioned, we were dedicating to security-related issues, countering Russian and Chinese malign influence. But for me, it was almost 10th year. And, you know, the agenda was very split. And I really wanted to focus more specifically on the Central Europe and specifically much deeper into countering Russian information warfare, mainly in the Czech Republic and Slovakia. So that was basically the reason. And also the second reason was that in the Czech society, but also in the Slovak society, we saw alarming trends to some point that almost half of the society in both countries, of course, in Slovakia is much higher, wants a government of a firm hand, or nearly 60% in the Czech Republic is dissatisfied with the developments after the Velvet Revolution in 89, or, you know, that 40% of Czech society actually trusts to conspiracy tendencies and all kinds of manipulation. So we really want to contribute this, and our mission is practically to enhance societal resilience towards disinformation and authoritarian tendencies in the Central Europe, but as I mentioned, specifically in the Czech Republic and Slovakia. So yeah, I would consider myself as an advocate for democracy, and we see that democracy in Slovakia is falling, unfortunately. It's turning more towards autocracy. We saw that already the Prime Minister Fico openly, vocally claimed that actually this Tuesday on the V4 meeting in Prague, where together with Viktor Orban, they practically said that the European Union can't decide who is responsible for the war in Ukraine, and that doesn't have any military solution, according to them. And they both agree. And I had an assumption that Robert Fico was more radical than Viktor Orban. So I think this is something we need to deal with much more. And yeah, we can talk more.
So how do you build this resilience? How do you make societies resistant to Russian lies and propaganda, and having, you know, like 17 versions of a news story in circulation the moment that it happens?
Well, we specifically in our center, we want to do it practically via three ways. One, it's more long-term, and that's education. We work with students under our program Security Academy, where we practically educate the future leaders of foreign and security policy who will be motivated enough to stay working for the Czech Republic, for the public sector or the army in the field of foreign security policy, practically. It is so far quite successful. It started actually already under the brand of European Values, but then from summer, we are working on it under CIS. And it's a very successful program because overall, we have like success rates, 87%. These students, they really stay working for the state. So this is what we need in a long-term view. Second approach we have is that we work with the parliament. We work with staffers, with assistants to members of parliament. We have for them competency and capacity building program, again, on foreign and security issues. We do provide them with briefing. We open them ways and we connect them to the security institutions in the Czech Republic, but also elsewhere in Europe. So this is also like one approach. Second is, of course, monitoring and analysis of the threat and making awareness. So practically at this moment, what we see that needs to be done is practically map what exactly happened in Slovakia in the field of hybrid, Russian hybrid operations, and how the state practically failed in countering disinformation, because that was really what happened in a way, and why Robert Fico won the election for the fourth time. He's the prime minister. So that's it. And then also the approach is that we have to work closely with the civil sector and private sector. Of course, there also has to be coordination with the government. So we are trying very, very slowly to establish this whole society approach, what we could see that it works in Baltic states. And then, of course, last but not least, it's the strategic communication. That's something what democratic governments are failing in. Also, the government in the Czech Republic is not doing enough. In less than 2 years, they have parliamentary elections. Their numbers are pretty low in the polls. The rise of populism is extreme, even for the Czech Republic. And so the whole situation doesn't look very good. One reason is that they don't want to invest any finances to build the strategic communication, because for that you need at least like one person at each ministry who would be dedicated to the strategic communication. Then you need some coordination body. There were several attempts here in the Czech Republic to try to establish them. There was a new office under the government office with the aim to create some kind of action plan against disinformation and how to apply also more of strategic communication. And all these efforts practically failed. One reason I think it is that the team was in a way released. There is still a few people doing monitoring of the disinformation, but one of the results of the action plan was also that you have to invest the money into the projects, also with the civil society, but also you have to invest money into yourself, into your own people. And I understand that in the situation where we are now, maybe governments, they don't see it as a priority. But then with these trends in the society, whether, you know, frustration is on a rise and radicalization as well. And when you don't communicate properly with your citizen, then of course populism will be on the rise, because they do communicate in much more simplified way, which is more understandable for their voters. So that's, I would say, where we are now with the situation.
Talk to us a little bit more about strategic communication, Stratcom. You mentioned a bit earlier the Baltics, because I was going to ask you about what is the model, what is the example for that. And tell us how one, because it seems to be the Baltics are former Soviet Union. It doesn't seem to be the issue of populism, doesn't seem to make societies that have a communist background more prone than others. We have just as much populism in the United States or in Western Europe at this point. So how can we think about strategic communication? Why are the Baltics so good at it? And what are they doing that is working? Because we know that at the level of generally NATO and particularly the European Union, we've been approaching this ever since it has become let's say, fashionable or a problem after 2014, we've been focusing a lot on debunking. But by the time we start addressing all the lies that Russian propaganda has issued on a topic, it's too late. Just like you said, the populists are already out communicating these false points in simple terms. And I can come out, even if I have a big voice, and say, tell people in 5 ways how this is all wrong and tell them what the data is, but it's not going to work. By that time, it's too late. So whether we're looking at the Czech Republic, where you're based, or the Baltic states, or the United States, how can we think about strategic communication that is actually efficient in preventing the impact that Russian propaganda, for instance, already has on citizens?
Thank you for this question. It is actually the crucial key is coordination and really the whole society approach. I'm mentioning Baltics because, you know, there is no doubt for them and for the society that Russia is their enemy. So they are pretty aware. In the Finland, is for example, it is a combination of very good education system that they have media literacy even from kindergarten to elderly people. But this is already ongoing for years and years and years. In the state, for example, like in the Czech Republic, whether you want to change something immediately and when you invest now in the education, that won't help practically anything because you will see results in like 20 years. You know, it's not like an immediate effect when you now invest into education. So one thing and one lesson what we could also learn from Ukraine, from, you know, the full-scale invasion, was the coordination. That's really the key. They have actually two separate centers who are dealing with hybrid warfare, disinformation, and strategic communication. So they decided that one of the center will be the coordination body for the rest of the institutions and ministries. So once the war started, they coordinated pretty quickly, and it was exactly, you know, that they had on the most of the ministries at least one or small team of people who would deal with Stratcom, and then they created narratives and they spread it in a very coordinated way. The message was clear, and these are, I would say, the really basics of the Stratcom, not to be reactive, but be proactive and bring to the public discussion. You have to be the agenda setter. You have to create your own positive narratives, and it has to be, you know, based on that. You have to increase it diverse. What is your target? For example, if you want to increase the trust in the public institutions, that's also, for example, one concept of strategic communication. So then you have to bring to the public sphere positive narratives, like, I don't know, some connotations with history, with democratic values, you know, why we are all of us doing it, etc. So these are, I would say, two crucial things: the coordination of institutions spreading the same message and having the same image for the citizen, and then be proactive and bring your own agenda.
I'm glad you brought up the parallels between Czechia and the situation here in the United States. Your exposition sounds unfortunately familiar to an American. So it raises the question for me. One of the things that's distinctive about disinformation and conspiracy theories and the like in this country is the sort of demographics of it. There are definitely parts of the citizenry, parts of the country, you know, particular social strata who are prone, who consume this information, get a lot of meaning out of it that they don't necessarily get from government or mainstream media and so on and so forth. And that makes it a very difficult problem for the government to address. Can you sort of give us a portrait of what the situation is like in the Czech Republic and whether there's a pre-existing social divide that the Russians and like-minded bad people are exploiting?
Yeah, so the Czech Republic, the situation is that the society always identified themselves more with the West than the East. This is the difference between Czechs and Slovaks. You know, even where we were one country together, Slovakia identified themselves always more with the East. Even now in Slovakia, the half of the society considers the USA as a threat to the security of Slovakia. And still nearly 40% by this situation that they have next door, you know, the war, that 40% considers Russia as a strategic partner, and 20% of the society believes that there is no war in Ukraine. And all this is based on the disinformation campaign and populists who were spreading these narratives and who practically normalized the pro-Kremlin narratives in the society. And social media, unfortunately, they are responsible also for this, because the regulation is not enough and we see the outreach of these narratives and these politicians who has these views, and it's enormous. I will just give you an example, and it's very similar, actually, the outreach of politics, for example, on Facebook between Czech Republic and Slovakia. So in Slovakia for the last year, the Prime Minister Robert Fico, he had nearly 7 million of engagements on the Facebook overall. And then the first democratic politician who is there is President Čaputová, and she has 2 million. So you can see the difference between the radical part and really the disinfo part and the democratic part. And then in the Czech Republic, you have the situation whether the numbers are slightly lower, but very similar. It's the Tomio Okamura, leader of the far-right extreme party. He had for the past year 6 million of interactions. Then Andrej Babiš, former prime minister, he has also like nearly 6 million of engagements. And then you have, again, the first democratic politician is President Pavel, who is somewhere around 3 million. So it's significant. In Slovakia, I would say the fragmentation of the society is in much worse stage, much more, because really Slovakia is on the way to autocracy like Hungary. And Czech Republic, I would say Czech Republic still can do something about it. And that's why I was mentioning the strategic communication, because I think that in this situation where the Czech government is at this moment, that this is the practically easiest way how they can change something, you know, if they change the communication. And they don't have to even invest the money in it. They could, I don't know, train the people who are already working at this position, or change some of these people who are there, you know, or change the monitoring for the communication, etc. But if you ask about disinformation scene in the Czech Republic, we saw actually after the COVID-19 pandemic slightly decline of the significance of the disinformation outlet in the Czech Republic. And also one of the reasons was that politicians overtook these narratives. So, you know, the disinfo outlets, they didn't have to do it anymore themselves, but it was politicians writing these statements and these narratives, and they still are. It's mainly those with the most engagements on the social media, because that's popular, that feed the algorithm, and it's actually when you have, for example, you know, the stage of the society, I would say that it's also fragmented in Czech Republic, but not that much. You still have more people who think critically, who are reading, who are aware about what's going on. But then you have like big number of people who are lost in the information, and people who are with the higher frustration, you are losing your interest in democracy overall. You are just taking care about the basic stuff, what you eat, you know, how do you feed your family, and this kind of stuff. And this is becoming more and more like normal in the Czech Republic, that even the people here are trying to, you know, less think about their like active role in protecting democracy or something like that. So we can see these trends. And I also think that it's very dangerous, you know, thanks to our language proximity between Czech Republic and Slovakia. Actually, one third of narratives are being shared. And with this situation after the Slovakian election last year and the winning of Robert Fico, whether, of course, Russia was a big helper, Russia might actually move their attention towards the Czech Republic and try to get more influence on the frustrated society. You know, disinformation proxies might get more financial support from them. We are very curious, practically, if this happens or when it will happen. I think closer to the parliamentary elections it might happen.
So I have, if I may, I have two observations which you might want to react to or not, and a question. The first observation has to do with this question of online engagement that different political leaders have. It strikes me that there is a real dividing line between political leaders and political institutions and parts of government that simply do their jobs and govern and legislate and talk about policy, and the class of political leaders who are also, so to speak, in the entertainment business. To compare the two, it is very obvious what is driving Andrei Babiš's engagement numbers or Donald Trump's engagement numbers on social media. I mean, it's just, you know, great fun to watch these people make these outrageous claims and, you know, spout out conspiracy theories. And people get jollies out of it that they probably be getting elsewhere, you know, maybe watching TV shows or going to Broadway or to their local church or something like that. It like fills a hole in people's lives that's not directly related to policy and politics and public life. And I suppose one answer to this challenge is to somehow get people to assign less importance to politics and turn them away from just like consuming political information and treating it as a source of entertainment. I have no idea how to do that, but that strikes me as, you know, a problem that we see on both sides of the Atlantic. Now, my second observation is that there are an awful lot of differences in how these things play out in different countries. So this sort of like canonical stratcom approach to things that you see in places like the Baltic states and Central and Eastern Europe in the context of Russian disinformation, I think would rub really the wrong way in America, where, you know, the idea that sort of the federal government would be in the business of sort of countering disinfo. I mean, people would scream bloody murder like immediate, and it would become instantly a sort of subject of culture war. And I think there is a real degree of sort of context specificity about how you sort of deal with this. I mean, you know, like the Republican Party arguably has been very prone to Russian promoted conspiracy theories. Most recently, in the Hunter Biden investigation, one of the sort of people who were supplying information was this guy Smirnov, connected to Russian security services. And it, I don't think that's something that could have been sort of countered by like official debunking campaigns or by saying, oh, like we need people better educated. I think, you know, it could have been countered by the Republican Party elites actually having a backbone and saying no and standing up to such nonsense at a particular point. So, yeah, like the way you sort of deal with this info in Baltic states, the way you deal with this info in the Czech Republic, in France, in the United States, I think will inevitably be sort of different and will sort of involve different sort of coalitions of actors. I'm skeptical that there are sort of one size fits all solutions to all this. I mean, America, after all, the land of paranoid style in politics, to some extent, it's going to be with us no matter what. Now my question is a slightly different one. So the Czech Republic has earned a reputation for being a staunch supporter of Ukraine throughout the full-scale invasion. It's been one of the sort of significant dividing lines as of late between the Czech Republic and Poland and the rest of the Visegrad 4. Are you worried that as these Russian narratives penetrate Czech society, as the country is headed for an election in 2 years' time, and as a fatigue of sorts sets in, that this Czech support and perhaps even Polish support could be increasingly in question? Do you think that if there is a change of government in Prague with, you know, Andrei Babiš making a comeback, we would see a very different approach towards Ukraine and the Czech Republic joining the camp of the Hungaries and Slovakias of Europe rather than being, you know, what it is today?
Well, it's hard to predict because Andrei Babiš is also, you know, very pragmatic. So I think on the European level, he might still do what European Union wants. And also still, you know, even after 2 years, it's interesting then you don't have like that fatigue in support of the people in Czech Republic, that they still do support even from their own sources. Czech Republic was also advocating for these like 10,000 drones for Ukraine, a massive campaign, or some Czech businessmen themselves, they donate like extreme amount of money, and also regular people, they still do and they still contribute, you know, to the support. But it might change. I think it's like this frustration level that's like new global thing. I think it's a combination with the, of course, influence of the social media, that you have like too much information everywhere. And also, as you mentioned, that people, they don't care that much about the political leaders, etc. So in 2 years' time, definitely the prediction would be that there would be, of course, more fatigue if the war is still on. But also Czech government is still, you know, even like this week in Paris on the summit meeting, Czech Republic came up with new idea, another new package, and some of the countries are already supporting it. So yeah, and on the European level, I would say that, you know, I was actually last week in Berlin, in Germany. There is, I think, much more fatigue, and the society doesn't get the war. It's too far for them, and the radicalization is there. They will have the regional election pretty soon, and the predictions are that some parts of Germany could be easily won by AfD party, the radicals. So I think it's a dangerous phenomenon, not only in Europe, but in US and other places, of course. And I didn't want to say that Stratcom is like the unique decision and unique measure which will work. Not really. You, of course, in a long-term view, you need to invest in media literacy for sure, but also I think that what we are still not doing in a more systematic way is, you know, advocating on platforms, on social media, that they really have to be more responsible for the content there. But then, yes, this is very difficult. These discussions, it's one big circle because they don't want to lose their money, of course. So yeah, but if we don't solve this issue and manipulation, you know, by deepfake and AI, so the world would be much more divided and people would be even like more lost in everything, and they would lose the trust, I would say, in everything. So yeah,
let me also ask you about Russian propaganda per se. Of course, that's your object of analysis, and we've heard before the full-scale invasion and in the context of the full-scale invasion a bunch of narratives. Some of them are now too well known, like denazification of Ukraine, all of that stuff. But as you're looking into the Czech Republic and Slovakia themselves and at the regional and European level, if I were to ask you, what are the top Russian narratives that you find are most impactful and hence the biggest threat to democracy in the region and on the continent in general, what would you say?
I would say the number one is definitely, you know, the war peace narrative, that we want peace practically and that we don't war. I would say that that's the most common. It was actually used also in the Czech Republic by Andrej Babiš, you know, when he was running for the presidential office. It didn't work out well for him by the time, but it might work in the parliamentary elections now, and he's already using these narratives. So yeah, it worked for Robert Fico and so on, you know. So the longer conflict in Ukraine is ongoing, then of course you will have more frustrated people who might start to believe more towards this narrative. So that's it. That in our region, of course, also the migration narrative, it still works. The narrative that you have to take care about your own people rather than the Ukrainian refugees or other refugees. And there is still like not finished discussion on the European Union level about the quotes on migrants, etc. So it's still something what is around Europe. And the third one, I would say it would be maybe the combination of denazification of Ukraine and that NATO promised to Russia that there will be no more enlargement of the eastern flank, you know, which is also not true. But this is in the Czech Republic slightly on some levels, but still with very low impact and presence. In Slovakia, it is already on high numbers. Even Robert Fico used it several times during the past weeks. In Hungary, this is also the topic. So these three, I would say.
Is there a kind of subliminal narrative of Russian power and strength and sort of inevitable victory despite the cost in blood, Russian forces willing to destroy any city or any infrastructure that lies in its path, and that it's just, you know, the cost of resisting a Russian revanche is too high to pay. 2 years hence, if Donald Trump is the American president, if that dark path is the one that plays out, there's just the simple fact that Russia will have asserted and possibly, or, you know, enshrined territorial conquest. Even if Putin himself is no longer on the scene, it's hard to imagine a democratic turn in Moscow. Just the Russians' ability to wear down the West that seems to undergird. That's why we want peace, because fighting is very unpleasant and very costly. And this is a very powerful narrative sort of among some elites in the United States, that Russia is kind of this irresistible power. And yeah, they may be sort of incompetent and willing to sacrifice their soldiers at an obscene rate, but what can you do?
Nobody can suffer like the Russians.
Exactly. They've turned it into a contest of who's willing to pay the most, and that's a very, very difficult for comfortable Western elites to get their heads around.
Yeah, and you know, populists in Europe, they are using fear that Russia is strong and will defeat us. So we have to, you know, deal with them, you know, end the war peacefully, give them what they want practically, and so on. Well, yeah, everyone wants peace. Also, the Western leaders, they want the peace. It was stated clearly also by the Prime Minister Fiala of the Czech Republic that he wants peace too. But the only way how we can have the peace is that Ukraine has to be independent and has to win the war. And Ukraine cannot win it without Europe. And European leaders, you know, should be much more aware of that, because it's in all Russian doctrines that they want their old post-Soviet countries. And so it's dangerous. So we have to be, I think, stronger and, I don't know, more united and support the Ukraine more, so the war is not that long.
As long as appeasement is still out of fashion in the Czech Republic, then there's a hope.
As long as the sort of historic memory of Munich is alive. And I'm glad we are ending on a note of quiet determination, because I think that's what the present moment is calling for. Andrea, thank you so much.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
From me, Dalibor Rohač.
Me, Giselle Donnelly, and
Julia Zsozsa.
Thank you for listening to The Eastern Front, a podcast dedicated to security challenges that have erupted along the line running from the Baltic Sea to the Black Sea, and why they matter to the United States. You can find more content on our website, aei.org. You can find us on Twitter using the hashtag EasternFrontPod, written as one word. You can also sign up to our newsletter using the link included in the show notes to receive more content from the Eastern Front. If you enjoyed this episode, appreciate this content, please consider subscribing, rating, and reviewing us. It helps others find the show. Thank you, and goodbye.